Here today, we hadn't been in Lubbock, or I hadn't been in Lubbock. My wife came back some years ago, but I don't remember last time I was here. But I was from here for 2 years, many years ago, when I was young, Brother Tommy Hicks. I'm still young, I just don't look young. You've been teaching in a preaching school, tell you, some of those students, you can't trust them. When I first got to Austin back in 1987, my hair was black. It was just beautiful and black. And now you see my hair. I'm glad my face is still very young, but we only do what we can. But I really appreciate having been invited to this congregation. I've never been here before. I've known Tommy for a long time, but I had never been to Southside Church of Christ. So I'd like to thank the elders and Brother Hicks and all those who were involved in inviting us to be here. My wife came with me this time, and she's been traveling with me more now that her girls have taken off. You know, I'm still in denial. I mean, my wife not, but it's not easy when your children grow up, and especially when you hear about them might be getting ready to have family themselves. That's a very hard thing for someone my age to take, but things have to happen. But anyway, this afternoon I'm going to talk to you about the letter to Titus. And like some others have said before, there's a lot of material involved here, and there's just no way, no possible way. I went over my lecture over and over and over, and there's just no way for me to be able to cover it all. You might have to go and look in the lectureship book on some of the material that I'm not going to be able to present. I'm going to mainly try to deal with what some scholars, or supposedly known scholars, I heard a friend of mine preacher say one time that many times people get educated beyond their intelligence. And that's what I see sometimes when I read books written by scholars. I'm not going to say that everything scholars have to say is wrong or unimportant. There's a lot of benefit that we can receive from studying scholars. But sometimes they go completely off in their discussions and some of the things that they claim they have found, when actually they have found nothing new from what we've known for years. But this time I'm going to talk about the denial that Paul actually wrote 1st, 2nd Timothy and Titus. It wasn't until the 19th century that we had scholars that began to deny the Pauline authorship. One by the name of F. Chalier Marcher, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, he argued that the Apostle Paul had not authored 1 Timothy on the grounds of language and style. Because of his questioning Paul as being the author, some began to do a critical study that would focus on philological evidence to determine who the author was. And some of the words I'm going to use, you might have to look up in the dictionary like I did to see what they meant. But all the words that I'm using are in reference to words and languages and the style of the writer who was Paul that wrote 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus. Anyway, Chalier Marcher, he was the first one. Then came J.G. Eichhorn. He also questioned Paul as being the author based on differences of religious language between pastoral writings and Paul's other writings. In 1835, F.C. Bauer rejected Paul as being the author of the pastorals based on how similar the heresy mentioned in the pastorals was to the second century heresy of Gnosticism. In 1889, a man by the name of H.J. Holtzman began to build on what his predecessors had begun earlier. It's funny how sometimes, I don't know if you've ever been lost, And you see someone in front of you that looks like he knows where he's going, and that person also is lost. And so you follow that person, and all you end up doing is just getting more lost. And then you get so lost that you don't even know where to start to get back to where you started. And this is what I see sometimes when we study books written by writers, scholarly writers, and as I've said before, not all scholarly writings are wrong and unbeneficial, but sometimes some of the scholars are really lost. They're I want to say, delusional, maybe, imagining things that are not there. And so we have to be very careful. And sometimes these, they don't have to be scholars. Sometimes it can be very well-known preachers. We are not followers of preachers. The Bible instructs us that we are followers of Christ. If we ever have doubts about a certain part of the doctrine of Christ, we just need to study it more and more and more. And not because brother so-and-so or brother so-and-so. I respect some of the brethren that have come before me. And I try to read a lot in the school. I have to read a lot to keep up with the students and be able to answer most of the questions that they ask. But I always, when I study, I always remember that brothers like Brother Guyon Woods and Brother Warren and so many other brethren that preached for many years, great preachers, great writers, and great debaters, I always remember that they were not inspired, like I'm not inspired. But I know that the Scriptures are inspired, and therefore I can always go to the Scriptures and find the answer myself. And actually, we're commended by God to be good students of the Bible. It's a commandment from God. If we want to be found approved of God, by God, we need to be able to use the Word of God rightly divide the Word of truth. And so this H.J. Holtzman, now he actually, what he did, as far as I can see from everything that I studied on, and actually, before I had this assignment given, I had never heard these names. It's like one time somebody asked me, what was the name of the 10 spies, the 12 spies that went to spy the land? All I remember was Joshua and Caleb. I didn't remember the other 10. And because they really are not important. They gave the wrong information. They were negative. They thought they were not possible to go into the promised land. So why should I even bother learning their names? Now, Joshua and Caleb, they were important because they gave a positive report. And so some of these names, I'm just mentioning them so you might get to know who they were, but the information they came up with as far as trying to argue, the arguments that they supposedly had to prove that Paul was not the author of 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus, once we look into those arguments, we see that up to a certain point, they start to make sense until you study them. It's like sometimes we hear people say certain things and say, you know, you're making a lot of sense. But then we start thinking about what they said, and we realize that they're really not making any sense at all. But when we first hear things we never heard before, sometimes we can be easily persuaded or easily convinced unless we study for ourselves. And so this man by the name of H.J. Holtzman, now he began to build on what his predecessors had begun earlier. His argument against Pauline authorship was the most complete of all predecessors. And actually, once you see what he said, it was actually the total of the other arguments made by the other men. It's like one of the books I teach in preaching school is the book of Job, and I've taught it for many, many years. And so there's one young man by the name of Elihu, who was younger than the other friends of Job, who thought he had the answer why Job was suffering and all that. And he thought he had an argument against Job, and he actually just said the same thing that the other people had said. And many times I see students in class, and they're going at each other like they're debating, and I have to stop them and I say, you all don't know it, but you're on the same side. Sometimes people don't have enough information on what they're discussing. They're actually in the same side. They just don't know it. But anyway, this man actually had the same arguments. He had, we call them objections. He had five objections. The first one was that he used to say that Paul had not written the epistles of Timothy and Titus, was that the historical references found in the epistles did not relate with the narrative found in the book of Acts. Many times they try to say that Paul could not have written 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus because they just cannot see where to find that in the book of Acts. And chapter 28 of the book of Acts, we don't see where Paul might have gone to Crete, where he left Titus supposedly, or to Ephesus, where he left Timothy. And therefore, based on that argument, that it just doesn't coincide. It just doesn't fit. Sometimes I go to the store to buy groceries. As you get older, you understand that you forget what you park, and sometimes you even forget what you're driving. And once I was coming back to where I thought I had parked, and I had the right car, the right color anyway, and I kept pushing my alarm key, and it wouldn't open. And I said, what in the world? And I tried again. I said, oh, this battery must have gone out again. And I was doing it the wrong car. There was just one car right next to it, just like mine. And so it just didn't make sense. And once I realized what had happened, it started to make sense. If we try to fit in the historical references that are found in the epistles, fit them all in into what happened in the book of Acts, sometimes it's not going to be possible. And also we need to understand that not everything that happened to Paul is written in the book of Acts. Sometimes they're just general statements that we find in the book of Acts, and later on we found out by studying other books, and we found out that actually they did happen while things were happening in the book of Acts. They do relate. The second objection that this writer wrote was in reference to the style and the vocabulary that was used by the Apostle Paul. It didn't coincide. The 10 letters of Paul that no one questions versus the letters of Timothy and Titus. The style and the vocabulary did not coincide. But sometimes, you know, we use different words. It depends what we're dealing with. And it is possible for the same person to be using a different kind of language and if he's discussing a certain subject versus another subject. Many years ago, I was given a lecture to preach on abortion. And that was quite a lecture that I had to research. And I had to use a lot of terms that I had to look up in the dictionary myself and terms that I wasn't used to using. Some of the students get all excited when they start going to preaching school and they start using words. Sometimes I wonder if they know what they're saying, like pericope. You don't hear those words. Those are not common words, but you hear them in school, in a preaching school, and other words. And so anyway, here, based on style and vocabulary, a third objection was heresy. Was that the heresy found in the pastorals, I'm using the word pastorals to refer to 1st, 2nd Timothy and Titus, the heresy found in the pastorals was the same as the heresy of the 2nd century Gnosticism. Some, this man in particular, thought that Paul was actually discussing Gnosticism in the epistles of Timothy and Titus. And actually what he was doing, he was assuming. A good friend of mine by the name of Ira Rice, and many of you probably know Brother Rice, knew Brother Rice, he and I got to be good friends. We worked together for a good number of years, and we used to kind of kid around a lot with each other. Sometimes he would come to the Southwest School of Bible Studies and preach in chapel. And one time he told all of us and the students, he says, never assume, because when you assume, you're going to be 9 times out of 10, you're going to be wrong. We make assumptions. Why did you do that? Well, I thought that's what you wanted. No, you can't assume. It's better to ask. And so this writer, I think, was assuming that Paul was actually discussing Gnosticism in the epistles of Timothy and Titus. Also, another objection was, the fourth objection that he brought was based on theology. The theology discussed in the pastorals was not the same as the theology found in the other writings that were not questioned as far as Paul being the writer. And the fifth objection was the organization of the church. As we study and some of the other speakers dealt with 1st and 2nd Timothy, they discussed things that had to do with the church, the elders and the deacons. What makes a good minister, a good gospel preacher? The letters of Timothy and Titus deal with all that. And also some other things that had to do with worship services. And so this writer said in particular that Paul very likely was not the writer of the pastorals or the epistles of Timothy and Titus because he concentrated on organization of the church when he didn't do that with his other 10 letters that he wrote, which no one ever questioned. But you know, sometimes when we hear things, they sound right. Until we begin to research and investigate and study for ourselves. I'm going to go into each one of these five objections that this man by the name of Holtzman brought to argue or deny that Paul had actually written 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus. The first objection that we would discuss was the style and the vocabulary. Holtzman found the pastoral epistles contain many words that were rarely found in the New Testament. Some of these words were such as man-stealers and uncorruptness. Also, many of Paul's most significant words are not even found in the pastoral epistles, And if they're found, they are used with a different meaning. For instance, the word righteousness is found in the pastorals meaning a virtue to be sought. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 11. Rather than being in a right standing with God. When Paul wrote like to the Romans or to the Colossians or the Ephesians, some of his other letters, and he was dealing with the word righteousness there, he was using the word righteousness to mean being in a good standing with God. But yet when he writes the epistles, or supposedly the writer, whoever it was, Holtzman doesn't believe it was Paul, that whoever wrote 1st, 2nd Timothy and Titus, when they use the word righteousness, they were using the word righteousness in reference to a virtue to be sought. Also the word son in the pastorals was never used to refer to Christ. No mention is found of the cross in the pastorals, which was a key term found in most of Paul's writings. And sometimes you go and you read and you study, and you even study, and you still don't realize certain words that were always there. Another book that I teach at the school, and I've taught it several years, the book of Genesis. You know, in Genesis 17 and 18, when those three angels, and one was the angel of Jehovah, came to Abraham and Sarah, and that Jehovah said to Abraham that within a year they were going to have a son. Another preacher friend of mine, was preaching on him, and I would listen to his tape, and he said that Jehovah told Abraham he was going to have a son, and his name would be Isaac. And I said, I've never seen that. I've seen that he was going to have a son, but I never saw that Jehovah mentioned him by my name. So I immediately went to the Bible, and I was doubting my friend. And there it was. The name was there. And sometimes we just don't see it. You ever been looking for something that's right in front of your face, and we just don't see it? And so here, you look at the 1st, 2nd Timothy and Titus. It doesn't take that long to go over it, and you can read it several times. And you look up the word cross, or you look at the word righteousness, some of the words that I've mentioned, and see how they're being used. And study how they're being used, and you will notice that at least at first glance, it seems like this person actually was making sense. E.F. Harrison summarized the statistics of the linguistic distinctives of the pastorals. He found that the total vocabulary, now this, I've never done this, the total vocabulary found in the pastorals was 902 words. Well, that's not important, you know, but still, when you're dealing with statistics, it is important. He found that the total number of words Paul used was 902 words. Of this total vocabulary, 306 words are not found in Paul's 10 other writings. And of these 306 words, 175 words are not found anywhere in the rest of the New Testament. So he sounds convincing. P. N. Harrison found additional statistics. He collected statistics to show how the language of the pastorals was not used until the second century, or so he said. But then there came some that came to the defense of Paul being the writer. A man by the name of J.N.D. Kelly showed how some of the rare words found in the pastorals did appear in Greek writings prior to A.D. 50. It is possible to explain Paul changing his style. One of the things that they were arguing or using as an argument why they believe Paul was not the writer of 1st, 2nd Timothy and Titus was that he used a different kind of style in his writings. But you know, as we get older, and all of us are getting older, even the younger ones are getting older, as we get older, we speak differently. Sometimes even our voices get squeakier, or I don't know, sometimes they get rougher. I don't know, but our conversations, another friend of mine, preacher, said one time, you know how you know when you're old, Al? I said, no. One way, you always talk about aches and pains. and that's what it seems to be the conversation of me and a lot of people my age nowadays. How long you been in the hospital? I mean, you know, our conversations change. And we talk a lot about diets also, and where is your sugar today? And I mean your sugar level. And because we're getting older. We're having certain problems that we didn't have before. Sometimes we're having problems with our parents. They're older, and we need to take care of them somehow, help them out, because it's so hard for the elderly sometimes to look out for themselves. And so things are changing. We change in age, And a lot of things, a lot of other things are happening. And so perhaps, at least in the defense of Paul, this what seemingly looked like a different style of writing was because Paul had changed, in his age was different. His life experiences were also different. Paul had already gone through things like some of us have. I remember when I first started preaching. It was a long time ago. I was 30 years old when I started preaching, actually. And now 24 years later, a lot of things have happened. And you get experience, whether you want it or not. You get experience. Some of the things you see, and some of the things you see actually come from the brethren that should not come from the brethren. You see churches doing things that are just not right. And sometimes you do your best to help the people, the congregations you're preaching for, and sometimes they don't appreciate it. Not too many people come and say, you did a good job in your lesson. There's not too many compliments made to us, but we keep on preaching. Sometimes when they got something to say, they didn't appreciate what we had to say, they'll tell us. But the compliments, where they say, you said this, but this that's not right. They're always trying to find something wrong with what the words that you use, the passages you refer to. Now, if you did do something wrong, I understand. But sometimes it's like they're ready to see what they can find. And when I first started preaching, I didn't think it was going to be that way. But I still appreciate preaching. I love preaching. I love to study the Bible and teach the Word of God. And I'm not going to stop. But it's just, you get experience. You get to see a lot of things. That's why preachers identify with preachers, and preachers' families identify with preachers' families, because we know what's going on. And so that explains the style. Now, the other thing is that, yes, Paul did not discuss the same things when he wrote, let's say, to the Romans or to the Corinthians, to the Ephesians, the Colossians, some of those verses, Timothy and Titus. Paul was a man, we need to remember, he was guided by the Holy Spirit when he was preaching and teaching and writing. He was guided by the Holy Spirit. So he gave the people what the people needed, not what the people wanted. Sometimes what the people want is not what the people need. And we have to be on the lookout, what do the people need to hear? Not what they want to hear. Because many times what they want is not what they need. And what they need is not what they want. And so another reason why it at least seems like Paul was not the writer was because he discussed different things. When he wrote to the Corinthians, he dealt a lot with the spiritual gifts because they were having problems with that. Some had more gifts than others, and they thought they were better than others, and so on. They were still carnal. 1 Corinthians 3, he said, I cannot speak to you as spiritual because you're still carnal. They had problems with Christian love, 1 Corinthians 13. He says, no matter what you do, if you don't have love, it's worthless. The needs of the Corinthian congregation were different than the needs when Paul wrote to Timothy and Titus. Paul dealt with the needs. What did the people need? And also another, at least a possible explanation why it seems like maybe Paul was not the one that wrote the 1st, 2nd Timothy and Titus. He was the one that wrote it, but at least it seems like he wasn't, was the words that he used in writing the 1st, 2nd Timothy and Titus. Another possibility is that he could have written it through someone else. Like when he wrote Romans, in Romans 16, verse 22, there it says clearly that the writer was someone else. But Paul was telling the writer what to write. And sometimes when you're telling somebody else to write for you, sometimes they don't say it exactly the way you said it. But there are at least possibilities why it at least seemed like it wasn't Paul the one who had written the 1st, 2nd Timothy and Titus. Now, the objection about the heresy, that Paul was actually trying to combat Gnosticism, which was a heresy that supposedly showed up more in the second century. Why Holtzman and others believe that Paul couldn't have written the epistles because he was actually, the writer was dealing with Gnosticism in the epistles, was based because Gnosticism, the doctrine of Gnosticism, denied Christ having resurrected, also alternated between moral license and asceticism, and also denied that it would be possible for man to have full knowledge of God and to be in fellowship with Him. The Gnostics felt that God's majesty was so removed from mere mortals that He created aeons, or subordinate creatures, to be mediators between God and man. So those were part of the what came to known as Gnosticism. And based on some of the things that they find in the writings of 1st, 2nd Timothy and Titus, they say, well, that's what Paul is trying to combat, Gnosticism. Because he talks about the resurrection of Christ. But the thing that Paul, when he referred to the resurrection of Christ, was that there were some who were saying that the resurrection had already happened. It had already happened. And Paul said, they're false teachers, and they're saying that it already happened when it hadn't happened yet. And that's all Paul was saying about the resurrection. It wasn't because he was trying to combat Gnosticism. And also because Paul referred to Christ as being the only mediator between God and man, 1 Timothy 2 and 5. Says Paul said that because the Gnostics, they were saying that, that there were other mediators. And so Paul is trying to combat that by saying that the only mediator is Christ. And so all that information seemed convincing. The another objection was the ecclesiastical structure problem. What this had to do with was in reference to the church organization that I was mentioning at first. When Paul wrote 1st, 2nd Timothy and Titus, he concentrated on church organization. You know, congregations, we need to teach and preach more on church organization. Sometimes we cannot assume that the brethren understand the eldership, they understand the deacons, understand the responsibilities of the gospel preacher. What do congregations look for, like, when they're trying to select an elder? Brother J.D. Tent once said, this is what Brother Rice said, so I'm assuming Brother Rice, you know, would be telling, he wouldn't be saying things about Brother J.D. Tent, but anyway, supposedly Brother J.D. Tent was invited on a gospel meeting somewhere so he could go and teach on in reference to the eldership because they wanted to appoint some men elders. And Brother J.D. Tent got back. They asked him, well, how did it go? Did some man get chosen to be elders? He says, well, they didn't meet the qualifications. They only met one. He says, what was that? They had the desire. Well, that's not enough. You got to meet all the qualifications that are found in 1 Timothy 3 and Titus chapter 1. Sometimes congregations, they need elders, and that's understandable. A congregation will work better if they have elders and deacons and everything set out the way it needs to be. But you don't choose just anybody to be an elder. And we know that's why we're having so many problems in so many places. There are elders that should not be there. And then those elders are going to make decisions that are just not right. They don't know the scriptures well enough to make the proper decisions. And plus, we're not doing things according to the scriptures. We don't have the authority. Well, he's a good businessman. He's a good man. Well, that's fine. He's very successful in his business. A business is a business, and the church is a church. They're two different things. And then when we choose elders that shouldn't be there, or deacons, gospel preacher, well, if he's young and good-looking and has several degrees, he should be a great preacher. What about the rest of us that are older and sometimes not so good-looking? You know, we can still preach, and we can still teach the Word of God. Sometimes congregations are looking for the wrong things, and that's why we go to Timothy and Titus, and there we have information as to what actually makes a good minister of Christ. Not according to men, but according to God. What does God say is a good gospel preacher? And Paul gives advice to Timothy and Titus as to what constitutes a good gospel preacher. So the ecclesiastical structure problem, the objection that Holtzman was having, that saying that Paul, if it was the same writer, if Paul did write 1st, 2nd Timothy and Titus, and we know he wrote the other letters, they didn't question the other letters like the Romans and the Corinthians and so on, why did he not discuss the same things? Why did he discuss different things in those different letters? Well, that doesn't take a genius to understand. The needs were different. Paul saw that Timothy and the people in Ephesus and also Titus in Crete, They needed instructions and information as to what kind of men they could select to be elders, what qualifications did they need to meet. Also, as far as some of the problems or false teachings that were going around, like in 1 Timothy 4, Paul talked about that there were going to be some that were going to teach to abstain from marriage and from certain foods. That was a problem that Paul had to address. And actually, that was asceticism. That was not Gnosticism. They're two different things. Paul saw the needs that those congregations had, and he tried to address those needs. And we also need to do the same thing. We don't address things that sometimes because we find them interesting. As preachers, we have to come up with two lessons every Sunday, two new lessons every Sunday, every week, every month, every year. And that's not easy. And sometimes as preachers, we're going to find some things in the Bible that are very interesting, and they are. And some things that we want to know more about, and we do want to know more about them, and we study them, and then we present them to the congregation. But the congregations don't need they'll need that eventually, but not at the time that we're trying to preach to them. We need to address the needs of the congregation. Someone's very hungry, and you want to help them, you don't give them water. Or if someone's very thirsty, you don't give them food. You give them whatever it is that they need. That's how we help people, based on what they need. And so this thing about trying to use this ecclesiastical thing as an objection that Paul didn't write the epistles of Timothy and Titus, because that's not the discussions that he did on his other letters. It just doesn't go. The historical problem, as I mentioned before, people tried to relate the things that happened in the book of Acts. And yes, the book of Acts, there we find a lot of things that Paul did and where Paul established many congregations. Brother Rick was talking about the Thessalonians. What is it, verse in the book of Acts chapter 17? Talks about when Paul went and he started the congregation in Thessalonica. In chapter 16, the congregation in Philippi. And so on and so on. A lot of what Paul did is found in the book of Acts and in the order that it actually happened. Now this light's too green. Okay, I hope I don't get them wrong, brother Tommy. But these are some of the objections that have been brought by some. They're trying to get what happened or what Paul wrote about in 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus to coincide with everything Paul did in the book of Acts. And sometimes it just won't happen. But the thing is that we don't know that the book of Acts wrote everything that happened in Paul's life. The book of Acts ends when Paul was in Rome in prison, but for the first time. As far as I can see, it doesn't discuss. You know, in 2 Timothy, Paul, especially in chapter 4, he talks about that he says that death is near. He knows he's going to die. Yet when he wrote to the Philippians, he told the Philippians that he was going to be able to visit them again. So why is Paul writing differently in 2 Timothy? Like he doesn't see a way out. Yet when he writes to the Philippians, he still has hope that he's going to be able to visit them again. And the explanation is that this must have been a second imprisonment when Paul was in Rome. And in between the first, or in between in the book of Acts and his second imprisonment, that's when he was able to go to Crete and leave Titus there and Timothy in Ephesus, and also write to Timothy the first and second letter of Timothy while Timothy was in Ephesus. It makes sense. Sometimes we don't make sense of the Bible because we're not making sense. It's just a matter of thinking and reasoning. And so this historical problem is not an argument that can be used. These lights are turning me off, but let me do what I can. The book of Titus, just hurriedly, Paul dealt with different things. In chapter 1, he talked about why was the reason that Paul actually left Titus in Crete. And that was because Paul noticed that there were certain things that were lacking in the church, especially that they needed to select elders. And so they needed to be taught in reference to the eldership. It's a very good thing. It's a very wise thing to teach and preach on the eldership to a congregation before they select elders and explain to them carefully what all those requirements are, also before they select deacons. And so there in Crete, the churches, they needed elders. And as I said before, a congregation with elders are going to work better. I remember I was working in Mexico, where our new son-in-law is from, Villahermosa, Tabasco. And I've been going there for a good number of years, almost every year. And sometimes I think I went twice, and I would preach to the congregations there in the area every time I went. And I had never realized that they have a lot of congregations, but none of them have elders. And they asked me one time, we're at a lectureship there, and my subjects were had to deal with other things, but they asked me, and says, have you ever taught Timothy and Titus at the school? And I said, actually, this was one of the courses that I teach. They said, well, can you teach us about the elders and the deacons? Because we want to do everything right. And it was supposed to be a one-hour lecture. It ended up like a three-hour-and-a-half lecture. And they had all kinds of questions. And Spanish congregations, they want to do what was right. But they want to do it right. Not just choose elders, anybody to be elders. They want to do it the way God commanded them to do it. And I imagine there in Crete, something similar was happening to the congregations there. And so Paul, it was necessary that Paul leave Titus there. To preach and teach in reference to the eldership and the qualifications that they need to meet. In chapter 2, it talks about the elderly helping the younger ones in advising them and training them how to be better husbands and better wives. Nowadays, sometimes one of the biggest problems that I see in the church is on marriage and divorce and remarriage, and sometimes I wonder if it's because husbands and wives don't understand the responsibilities. And so there in chapter 2, Paul tells Titus to teach the elderly, to teach the younger ones their responsibilities. And also in reference to the dealings between back then, they had slaves. They had, and sometimes the case would be where you had some that were servants, and then they had the masters. And the masters were Christians, and the servants became Christians. How are they going to deal with one another now? The owner of the slave was a Christian, and the slave was a Christian, so what do they do? If my employer is a Christian, and I'm a Christian, am I going to take advantage of my employer because we're brothers? No. Actually, it should be the opposite. I should do the best I can to be a good employee to that employer, because Colossians says that we need to think as if we were working for Jesus Christ. And so he talks about that, and then I'm out of time, so... you're going to have to read the rest of my lecture in my book. Thank you.